Hello and welcome to the FinTech Newscast. My name's John, and this week we have an interview with Shayla Burrows, the COO at Satis Group, a company which works on STOs, security token offerings. Please hit subscribe to keep up with our latest episodes. All right, welcome to the FinTech Newscast. With me this week is Monica.
Hey, John.
And Steve.
Hello, everyone.
And our special guest, Shayla Burrows from Satis Group.
Hi.
All right. Satis works on something that didn't exist just a few years ago. So you're really on the cutting edge of new types of blockchain and technology services.
Yes, we are on the absolute bleeding edge. Our founder, Emma Channing, worked on the first three security tokens to go to market in 2017, Blockchain Capital, Science, and Protos. And this past January said, you know, I want to focus on this entirely. And that's why she started Satis Group.
So can I ask you, before we dig deeper, what does Satis Group actually do?
We are a security token advisory. And so when I say there are a lot of advisors out there, everyone very recently became an ICO advisor. And I was like, wow, where did that come from? But really what we do is we work with clients to help them with their token economics. We work to help them find the right vendors to actually bring their security token to market. We ensure that they're doing so in the most compliant fashion possible under U.S. securities laws. And so we literally help them get their investment package ready to go to market, and then we literally take them to market and help them fundraise.
You do a roadshow when you do equities, issuances. Is it something similar to that for a token issuance?
Very much so. Especially with traditional institutions coming into this, that's really a huge part of this process.
So they're already comfortable with that part of it anyway.
I don't think anyone's comfortable yet. I think if you're feeling comfortable, you're probably not in STOs, or you just made a killing and then sold when Bitcoin was at 20,000 last year.
If you say you're at Woodstock, you probably weren't really there.
Right.
You can remember it.
Right.
So the other side is, how do you even find the investors to go, or is this kind of like a tight club that you know who's going to be a prospective investor?
We are at such a nascent stage in the market right now where really the entire market is still figuring out who the ideal investors are for this type of thing. And there are two main buckets, right? There are traditional institutional investors, and those who are looking into this space are in, you know, the left side of, you know, a Venn diagram, if you think about it that way, and they just want to flex into this type of a risk environment. And then on the other side, you have your crypto whales, right, who made just an absolute killing in Bitcoin or Ethereum, and then, you know, in previous ICOs, and they're willing to diversify into something like a security token, which might have a lockup period. And of course, in the very center of the overlap, you have Anthony Pompliano. You have people who are specifically focused on security token offerings. And all parts of that Venn diagram are starting to come into their own, and we're in the earliest stages. What I like to describe it as is we're not even on the baseball field. We're literally getting suited up into uniforms.
Very interesting. So that's actually a good segue into my next question, which is what are some of the use cases you've seen, either some that have just started, or some that you foresee taking place in the future for this kind of product?
So here's the theory that seems to be predominant among the people that we work with. Now, of course, it's a theory, and we have to see how this plays out over the next year or so. But the thinking is that typical securities that you see come to market, such as REITs or a consumer company that has been in the market for a long time and is very understood, very traditional investments that people can very easily understand are going to be the most popular, because it's very easy for investors on all sides to understand the value proposition of trying to interact with that business. And then the only hurdle to that becomes explaining how a security token works. and what the deal actually looks like from a structuring perspective. So our theory, real estate is going to be super hot, and pre-existing companies that have a very straightforward value proposition also may be hot.
So if I think of it as like the crypto version of a mortgage bond?
I would think of it that way, yes. And the problem that we've noticed in the marketplace is that investors are very comfortable with coming in on equity rounds for companies that might be a little bit esoteric. Say, for example, you're taking a extremely esoteric protocol to market. They see, you know, in that case, they're much more comfortable using a traditional finance mechanism to go after something that's really unusual. In my line of work, it ends up flipping around where it's an unusual or new form of financing, but they want to see a very traditional deal, if that makes sense.
So we have yet to see the Fannie Mae version of crypto mortgage lending.
I think we're in the very, very early stages of just about everything in security tokens.
It's so early. And just from what we read, the regulations aren't very clear, or sometimes contradictory, and jurisdictions are very different. How much of a, well, you can't give a money back guarantee, I guess, but how sure can you be that you're going to comply and that something is going to stay compliant since this is an ongoing enterprise?
I would say the way that we think about this is to be as conservative as possible and as in line with current U.S. securities laws as possible. I think that if you enter into an area where there is a lot of vagueness, for example, around the way they think about or approach that particular item, I mean, we're just typically very conservative anyway, as a company. And so we'll typically not really dive into something that is that vague.
Yeah, it's good to see, you know, like you were saying, or did I hear that last night? I was at a crypto talk last night for the CFA Society, and Coinbase was there, and they had a similar, very conservative approach. They saw themselves as a regulatory and compliance value. As far as the crypto space, since there's so many things that aren't, are way off base or outright fraudulent.
I honestly think that if you look at it from a go-to-market strategy, it makes sense to be conservative now because we've seen the volatility in the market is so incredible. And like, you know, there's some tweet that I saw a few days ago where of the top 20 cryptocurrencies, they've all lost more than 80% in value over the past, you know, over 2018 as of, you know, November 27 or so. So it makes sense to kind of focus on compliance. And I see that as a good way to maybe attract more institutional investors who are less interested in, you know, sort of the get rich quick schemes that we've seen across cryptos as well.
Yeah, you know, we like to liken it to being the girl at the high school dance who's wearing a turtleneck in the back of the room, and she might not be getting asked to be on the dance floor as much, but she's going to go to the best college, right? So, like, that's the way we're going to market, for lack of a better way of explaining it.
And sad for that girl.
That one's going to Harvard.
But she's got legs. She's going to last, right?
If you haven't had a chance to read a recent blog post by Fred Wilson, his blog is ABC, he went through the patterns that we're seeing now in the crypto market and compared it to the early internet age where you were seeing Amazon, you know, come to market and what was happening with their share price over time. And he maps it out in such a way that I think does in many ways mirror what we're seeing in crypto. And for anyone who's listening in on this and wants to take a look at what he's talking about, I think it's an excellent blog post to refer to.
Yeah, we'll make sure to add it to the show notes. Thank you.
So does the recent crash, I guess we can say, in prices affect things anyway? Are less people interested in this kind of in your services?
You know, what's really interesting is we've seen some of the best deals to date come to us in the last quarter. I think the regulatory movement is really great for our industry because it's forcing the deals to be really quality, to be real businesses, to be truly understandable, to bring a very real value proposition to investors who are very legitimate. And that's a really good thing, right? The thing that we're seeing in the market is that the demand side of it isn't really there just yet. They're still trying to wrap their minds around the security token market. So from a supply side, we're doing great. That part is not a problem.
Right. So something related is I went to a CFA Society talk last night on institutional investing in cryptocurrency. And, you know, I was really surprised. This was at the Lending Club offices here in San Francisco. And I went to a similar one last year. And I think they went to more into the basics, like, you know, investing in crypto last year. And the place was packed. They have like this stadium kind of bench seating on one wall. And that was all full last year. I remember trying to get a seat early so I wouldn't have to stand and listen to the presentations. I went to the same group, the CFA Society talk. It was institutional investing in cryptocurrencies. So more, the back end custodial issues, security, investor needs, that kind of thing. So a little bit different focus, and they assume that you know the basics by now, but the place was 20-25% of the attendance that it was last year. So that whole bench seating was empty. It was just, so I sat in the front row, no problem. And the presenters were pretty big, pretty decent names in the crypto investing world. It was a Coinbase and Bitwise and Iron Capital, and they're all focused on institutional investing and talking about the issues there. And they had that a long-term perspective. They pointed out that crypto has crashed before, sometimes for long periods of time, and come rushing back. So they didn't, at least outwardly, show any major concerns about the market going down, and especially for Coinbase, which is driven by transaction volume, that has to be drying up. But it was pretty interesting on that side. It sounds like you're filling in a service on the other side as well. Are you seeing the institutional interest affected very much?
Well, what's interesting, and I'm going to go into, I will get there, but I'm going to take you on a small journey to get to the answer to your question. And my question back to you would be, at that summit that you were referring to, it might be that there were, 25% of the people there that attended year previously, but what was the composition of that 25%? Did you notice more people in suits? Or are they true crypto people? Because I think the thing that we're noticing notably at these events, and it could be for a lot of reasons. I think, for example, crypto conferences have just been beaten to death. We're all tired and we're all just hunkering down until the holidays. So I think that's the first thing. But the second thing that we've started to notice, and this is just super subjective, but I think it's a feeling we're starting to get that's pretty telling, is that more suits are showing up to these events. So maybe there's, fewer short-term gamblers who rode the hype wave in the room, but we are starting to see more legitimate players start to enter and understand the space and want to really get to know the people who are a part of the long game. And that's the other facet that I want to mention, which is the people who are in crypto now who are playing the long game are truly in for the long haul, because we are in the bariest of bear markets right now. And it really is about being extremely patient.
These tokens, are a lot of these people using, I guess your customers are deciding what technology to use. Are these the Ethereum-based tokens?
They really vary in terms of what people want to use and why. And there are a plethora of technology providers. I think one facet that technology providers still have to look into is how to control these tokens in certain jurisdictions, how to build in literally compliance laws into the tokens.
Yeah, that's the hard part. That's your whole value add, right?
It's part of the, I think part of the value add, and I can go into the pros of this, are being able to, as I said before, bring some liquidity to assets that normally wouldn't have had that liquidity. So that's one pro. A second, which I'm very excited about as someone who worked in government previously, is that more often than not, you're having to regulate with a stick, not a carrot. I'm really excited about the ability to build in rules and compliance into a token such that the people who shouldn't have it won't get it in the first place. And you can automate that process through, you know, you can automate KYC and AML and build it into the token. I think that's really interesting and scalable and really good. And as, you know, someone who had to look at things at scale from a government perspective, that's really exciting to me.
Yeah, for sure. Well, we mentioned the real estate example. What's something that couldn't be securitized before that's easier or even possible to do now with tokens?
Well, we're seeing a lot of items such as artwork be tokenized, which might, you know, maybe you can own a piece of artwork, which I think is really interesting. And before
I own 1/1000th of a Van Gogh.
Right. Mine might be like 1/1,000,000th of it.
yeah, I was going to say. Yeah.
But I think that's really cool. And you're seeing that with collectible cars and luxury goods like jewelry and artwork, real estate. I'm pretty interested in what VC funds are using tokens for and being able to provide some trading and liquidity on shares in funds is really interesting. I think those are very good initial use cases. But of course, with any new
there'll be some,
you know, kinks. Wild West, we'll see. There are totally going to be kinks, right? So the people who are getting in this now are just know that this is going to be a little bit of a mess. And have some kinks that they have to work through.
So we're going to drive up fine art prices even higher.
And perhaps keep venture-funded firms from IPOing even longer.
That's right. Yeah, there's no need to go to the market if we can just raise funds.
Yeah, VCs can get some exit.
Yeah.
Who's going to pressure these companies to go public?
Or even go to a VC in the first place.
Potentially, yeah.
We've seen a reduction in VC funding in the US, and some of that can be attributed to companies not using ICOs to raise funds as opposed to going to Sand Hill Road and, you know, going that route.
I've been taking bets with friends over time to hear more about what they think is going to happen. I've heard two perspectives, which I find both very interesting. So my theory, and this is just a theory, is that seed stage and Series A funding will continue to thrive. And in my view, they need to, because at the beginning of a business, you really need thoughtful strategic partners to help you think through scaling and the same issues that plague every single other business. And then, you know, as you move forward as a revenue generator, you can use security tokens and you can use an alternative form of financing that's both non-dilutive but great for investors and then gives you the necessary funds to be able to run your business. So that's at least what I see happening, is that, you know, the seed guys and the Series A guys will stick around. However, I had a friend of mine say, nope, I think those guys are going to go in lieu of a different, you know, form of fundraising, and then it's gonna be the traditional growth guys that stick around. So honestly, I'm curious to hear what you guys think.
Yeah, I've seen some data on this, and I know that from a macro perspective, the VC funding now goes towards more the Series B and above companies. And there's been, you know, I wouldn't say that it's been dried up, but there's certainly been a decline in the amount of funding, the amount of total funding going to very early stage companies at the seed and even A level. So it's kind of the opposite of that. At least that's what the data that I saw a few months ago kind of bore out.
Well, we'll see how it goes over time. I think that really for me to be able to make a good assessment, we have to see the STO market really play with full infrastructure under them.
So business is good for SETIs.
Yeah, the pipeline, I think, is strong. Again, I think the big thing is just digging into and cracking the nut of the demand side. I think that's still coming along, just as the infrastructure is. Early days. Then I would say, if there's one thing I could leave those who listen to the show who are considering doing a security token raise, please, please use BrokerCheck. If you go into Google and you put BrokerCheck in search, it will bring up a directory where you can search someone's name or their broker dealer and literally see if they have the licenses to be able to work on your deal or take it to market. And I think that's so important. And it's something, you know, the thing I think sometimes from this industry, criminal record, it doesn't, I don't, you know, it will contain some of that information too.
Yeah.
But I think what's so important is to add a layer, a thick layer of common sense to whatever you do. So look people up through LinkedIn, look them up on BrokerCheck, make sure they're operating, you know, as they should be. There are a lot of characters that have come to us and we're like, nope, you had a Series 7 about a decade ago and you're not current. And I think that's good information for everyone to know.
No substitute for due diligence. All right. That's the takeaway for both of our listeners out there. All right. All right. Yeah. Thank you, Shayla. That was that's very interesting. We really appreciate your time and wish Satis Group continued success.
And now it's time for our final bites, where we take a look at a number and the story behind it.
I'll go first this week. My final bite is 2020, and this is the year in which Beijing plans to roll out basically pro-social profiling to its 22 million residences and start making social and financial decisions for them based on their social score.
It's interesting that they will be doing this without the help of Google, right?
Well, we'll see.
The whole world is not Google, Steve.
We'll see if Google gets in there by 2020. But certainly, I don't think China needs Google's help at this point to do this. I do want to just point out really fast that one of the quotes in here describes a high score as being in the green channel. And if you are not in the green channel, they use a quote of being unable to move even a single step. Which, wow, that sounds...
They say it like that, really?
I think they say it exactly like that.
That's wow.
Except in Mandarin. Okay. If you live in China, you might want to start doing some volunteer work, donating some blood, because those are some things that can up your score.
Otherwise, bu hao. Bu hao.
Which means?
Not good. Not good.
Not good.
No, bad, yeah.
Not good at all.
So, yeah, great. Thanks, Monica. So my final bite is $15,000. This is the amount that crypto analyst Tom Lee still says that Bitcoin, still says that the price of Bitcoin will achieve by the end of 2018, a mere 33 days from now. So seems highly unlikely. What do you think, Monica? We just saw a Bitcoin rocket back up to 4,300 from 3,600.
I can hardly speak for rolling my eyes.
Right. Yeah. Well, we've seen a severe drop across all of the cryptocurrencies because they're all correlated. Even though they're working on different projects, they have different models. They have a different consensus. They're focused on different parts of the market, but you know, which you would think would help diversify. If you had different cryptocurrencies, you know, some would go up, some would go down. But that, I guess, the market is so new that is totally not the case. I mean, these correlations between cryptocurrency prices is as close to one as you want to be seeing.
Yeah, and there are some other elements here. You know, Bitcoin and Ethereum take up such a huge part of the total crypto pie that there's a lot of other little also rands that may not have the same experience. The other thing is that, you know, this harkens back to some of our very first shows. Like, these currencies do not all in of themselves have an inherent value. And
that's for sure.
Well, I'm not I think there were some people who might still dispute that, including Tom Lee.
Well, though, there are some good ones, and you know, they're trying to create very useful capabilities, like we talked about EOS, and of course they want to be rich too, but you know, they're also hiring hundreds of programmers and developers and business models on top of that as well.
I honestly, what I think of more...
And then some that are not, are just one piece of paper and a quick trip to Barbados.
When I see the news about where these crypto values are, what I mostly just feel for are people who really shouldn't have made big plays into this marketplace and now have lost a lot of money. And this is... It's never a great time to lose a lot of money, but especially at this time of year, I just feel for folks. So,
well, one thing, that's right. It shouldn't be 100% of your retirement allocation. One target of alternative investments in the portfolio management world is for it to be about 5% only of your total investable portfolio. So, if it's above that, you're going beyond what's normally considered prudent diversification.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think to a certain extent, you could make the case that cryptocurrencies are such an alternative asset that you should need to be an accredited investor to even get in them. But we know that many people are not and have done dumb things like cash out their 401k, pay the tax penalty, and hodl to the end. And it just really bums me out to see people make stupid decisions like that.
Yeah. Yeah, well, if you did that in 2012 and got out in 2016, maybe you're okay, but you're taking some crazy risks.
It's still a stupid decision.
Yeah,
sometimes
right.
Stupid decisions work out. Doesn't make them smart decisions.
Yeah. But it's the exceptions that will be growing.
And it's not 2012.
It's not 2012 for sure.
Yeah, Steve? So speaking of stupid decisions, my number is 23, which is the number of taxes you'll be able to pay in Ohio using Bitcoin.
Oh, 23 different kinds of taxes.
Right. So
okay.
You can pay
property tax,
income tax, whatever, all that stuff, pay through Bitcoin. So this is both a tacit agreement of the widespread usage of Bitcoin, I guess, but it also seems like it's come in at the wrong time. Again, we're not in 2012.
It seems a strange time, right?
Right.
Government moves slow.
This is
the party's over.
Six
the punch
years.
Bowl has been taken away.
Six
now
years
Now Ohio
slow.
Jumps into the room and says, hey, let's dance.
Can we do this? Yeah. So this is based on a report in a Wall Street Journal last Sunday, but they say that Ohio understands that there's inherent currency risk in taking Bitcoin, essentially, for payments. So this company has stepped in and said that they'll take... they'll be able to provide risk insurance for about 15 minutes so that if the price, if you say, oh, 100 Bitcoin in your property taxes and then the price drops, the company will step in and make the government whole. But it's only for 15 minutes.
So they'll flip it for them into dollars right away anyway, right?
They don't
want the risk.
Exactly, yeah. Yeah, but it's still rather risky. And
Ohio,
I mean,
the fourth largest crypto investor in the country.
Yeah, and is Ohio planning on dumping those Bitcoins and turning them into dollars?
No, right away. Yeah.
Right away.
Yeah. Yeah.
So within... Just after 15 minutes.
Just after 15
that
minutes.
That may not be fast enough.
It may be too fast for Bitcoin to actually go through, given how long it takes for the transactions to go through, right?
Right. The transaction takes an hour and...
Ohio.
Well, next year we might have a story where the governor of Ohio has left the country with his Bitcoin,
with a suitcase full of Bitcoin.
I think John Kasich is more likely to run for the Republican nomination.
Yeah. It's also, I should mention, this is only for small businesses, not for individual taxpayers. So it's a smaller segment, but it still, you know, seems like a very risky and belated move from Ohio there.
Yeah. Yeah, interesting.
Is this like a boondoggle for the insurance company that's going to be protecting these for 15 minutes? This just sounds fishier and fishier.
It may be a boondoggle for the company, which is called BitPay, and they will basically step in and guarantee the price of Bitcoin for 15 minutes after the transaction has been started.
And that's it for this episode of the FinTech Newscast. If you have any questions, comments, or would like to see any topics discussed, please feel free to email us at info@fintechnewscast.com. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week.
Bye for now.
Later.